are listening to Right On Radio. I'm Eric Zimmerman. On tonight's program, Josh also talks to the acclaimed journalist Vince Beiser about his new title, Power Metal: The Race for the Resources That Will Shape the Future. Beiser's research shows the powerful ways the metals we need to fuel technology and energy are spawning environmental havoc, political upheaval, and rising violence, and how we can do better. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
I'm joined by Vince Beiser to discuss his new book, Power Metal: The Race for the Resources That Will Shape the Future. Beiser explores the Achilles heel of green power and digital technology that manufacturing computers, cell phones, electric cars, and other technologies demand skyrocketing amounts of lithium, copper, cobalt, and other materials. Around the world, businesses and governments are scrambling for new places and new ways to get those metals at enormous cost to people and the planet. Beiser is an award-winning journalist and author. He has reported from 100 countries, states, provinces, kingdoms, occupied territories, no man's lands, and disaster zones. Vince has exposed conditions in California's harshest prisons, trained with U.S. Army soldiers, ridden with the first responders to natural disasters, and hunted down other stories from around the world. Vince, welcome to Right On Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
The first chapter of your book is called The Electro-Digital Age. For our listening audience, could you describe what is the electro-digital age?
Sure. The idea there is we're really moving into a new era, and it's going to be defined by three overlapping interlocking drivers. Number one, renewable energy. We're shifting away from fossil fuels and towards renewables like solar and wind. Number two, electric vehicles, right? We're shifting, again, part of the energy transition towards renewables, getting rid of fossil fuels, moving towards everything being run on electricity. And three is the digital technology that we all, that's such an important part of all our lives that's, you know, making this conversation possible right now. So those three things taken together are going to absolutely transform how we do everything, how we get from place to place, how we heat our homes, how we power our civilization. But all of those things, all those three connected sets of technologies, they all depend on a basket of metals, and which we're going to need billions of tons of these metals. And the concern is that we need to make this switch in order to stave off climate change, which is the biggest threat of all. But if we're not careful about how we do it, we're going to swap one set of problems for another.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit more about that. You discuss the paradox of transitioning to renewables and electric vehicles while creating environmental and social preventing environmental and social damage. What are the most overlooked consequences of the transition, do you believe?
So there's a whole range. In order to get the metals that we need, which is a collection of things that, you know, as you mentioned, lithium, cobalt, nickel, copper, rare earths, these things come from many parts of the world. But to get them right now, we are cutting, rainforests are being cut to the ground in Indonesia. Children are being put to work in mines in Congo. A unique desert ecosystem in Chile is being threatened. Gangs of copper thieves are killing people in the streets of South African cities. It's a whole range of things. Warlords are getting rich in Myanmar. Warlords are getting rich selling rare earths to China. And even one of Vladimir Putin's oligarch pals is making huge amounts of money selling metals to the rest of the world.
You mentioned in your book that rare earths are among the most important of all the critical metals for the electro-digital age. The title rare earths, however, is somewhat of a misnomer. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, it's such a weird one, right? So rare earths are a set of 17, that term covers a set of 17 really obscure, weird metals with names like neodymium and yttrium and terbium. They're way at the bottom of the periodic table, if you remember your high school chemistry. But in fact, they're not earths at all. They're actually metals. And they're not really rare. There's lots of them scattered throughout the Earth's crust. The problem is they're found in very, very small concentrations. So you have to dig up an awful lot of rock and ore to get just a little bit of those so-called rare earths. And the reason that they're important, they're incredibly important to the whole electro-digital age. First of all, none of our electronics would work without rare earths. They all have sort of really super specialized uses that nothing else can do. Like the red in your screen, when you're looking at your phone or your laptop, the red in the screen is created by a rare earth called europium. There's other rare earths that make the touch screen work. Some other rare earths are used to help make the F-35, the U.S. military's most advanced fighter jet, work. Rare earths make the motors that make electric vehicles go. On and on and on. They're these weird little elements that we had barely any use for 50 years ago, and now we just absolutely cannot get enough of.
You illustrate a vivid image of mining in California's Mountain Pass mine in Chapter 3. I was wondering if you could talk about what you learned about the environmental and human costs of rare earth extraction there.
Sure. So once upon a time, not so long ago, California, that mine, the Mountain Pass mine in Southern California, it's out in the desert, sort of on the way to between LA and Las Vegas. It was the world's biggest producer of rare earths for a very long time. And then it closed down basically because the entire industry, or almost the entire industry, shifted over to China, just like so many of our other heavy industries. We basically offshored it. But because it's so important, because, you know, rare earths have become so incredibly important in the last few years, some folks, a group of investors, bought that mine and are trying to revive it. They've brought it back online. Now, one of the reasons that it went out of business in the first place was because all the environmental damage that it created. It spilled, it was leaking huge amounts of radioactive water into the desert. And the fines and the regulations around that were part of what drove it out of business and sent the industry to China, where they just don't care about that stuff as much. So now it's kind of, you know, the damage is sort of out of sight, out of mind for us here. But in China, which is now far and away the world's biggest rare earth producer, the main area where they're producing rare earths, which is in an area called Inner Mongolia, it's one of the most polluted parts of the entire planet. There are lakes just absolutely filled with reeking toxic waste. People living nearby have developed all kinds of terrible health conditions, hair falling out, teeth falling out. It's a real, it's really a nightmare. And the latest thing that's happening is even China has gotten tired of all the environmental damage, all the pollution that's created by rare earth mining. So they are also now outsourcing some of it to Myanmar, also known as Burma, the country right next door, where there's lots of rare earths and most of them are being mined by militias, basically by local warlords who just take control of an area, kick out whoever's living there, fill the mountainsides, just pump them full of chemicals and then draw the rare earths out.
What are the ethical implications of the global treasure hunt for resources, especially in developing regions? Is there any efforts to mitigate these impacts currently?
Sure. Well, I mean, as you said, it's a real paradox, right? Because we do need these things. We need these metals in order to build wind turbines, solar panels, electric cars, all the rest of the infrastructure of renewable energy, right? We've got to do that. We've got to get off fossil fuels to beat out climate change. So there's, you know, that's one ethical imperative. The other ethical imperative is, okay, but how can we do it without trashing the planet in the process, without exploiting and, you know, oppressing people in other countries or in this country for that matter? And so there is a lot of pushback in a lot of places. There are, you know, the local folks, indigenous groups in many places are really fighting hard against new mines opening up in places like Peru. They have huge copper mines there that have been shut down over and over and over again in the last couple of years by locals who are just like, no way, we don't want this mining in our backyard either. And it becomes a real balancing act, right? Because of course, you know, you can't argue with that, right? Nobody wants a giant strip mine in their backyard, But at the same time, you know, these metals have got to come from somewhere. And this is going to, you know, sounds kind of crazy to environmentally minded folks here in the US or Canada where I live. But I really believe part of the answer is we should really be allowing more mining to happen in this country. There are loads and loads of metals here. And, you know, it will cause damage. Mines inevitably cause harm. But mines in North America and in Western Europe, they're held to a much higher standard, right? We have much stronger environmental regulations, labor standards, all the rest of it. So it means that, you know, if you really care about these issues, if you want to see, if you want to make sure we have the raw materials to build all the renewable energy we need and the electric cars that we need, and you're concerned about the unfairness of making all the costs fall on people in Zambia and Indonesia and wherever else, you should really think about taking a second look at allowing at opening up or reopening some of the mines here in the United States.
Copper theft has been linked to violent crimes and social upheaval, particularly in South Africa. Could you talk about what's driving this phenomenon?
Yeah, it is. This is one of the craziest things that you know, that I had no idea about until I started working on this book. But basically, you know, we need lots and lots of copper for the energy transition. We're going to have to mine more of it in the next 20 years than we have in all of human history. And we've been mining copper for thousands of years. So there's this huge demand for copper, which of course drives the price up. And when the price of anything goes up, basically people are more tempted to steal it, right? Theft of it goes up. So this is happening all over the place. There's, you know, a wave of copper theft in the US and in Canada. But where it's really happening on an industrial scale is South Africa. And there you have heavily armed gangs that are just stealing on a massive scale, electric cables, train equipment, you know, all the pieces of the electric grid, basically, which are mostly made out of copper, right? That's what power cables are made out of. So the result is that, like, in the city in Johannesburg, one of the biggest cities in South Africa, parts of the city are blacked out every few days regularly because so much of the copper infrastructure is getting ripped up. Hospitals get shut down. Train lines have been closed down completely. And people are getting killed over it because there's so much money in it. There's so many people doing it that, like I say, these gangs are armed. And when security guards or police try to get in their way, often they get gunned down.
What strategies do you propose for minimizing the reliance on primary copper extraction while meeting the demands of the digital and energy transitions we're expected to have in the next 20 years?
Yeah, that's a great question because really, you know, I know I've been talking a lot of doom and gloom here, but there really are solutions. There are ways we can do this stuff better. And copper is a really good example. So this kind of goes across the board, what I'm about to say, not just for copper, but really to one extent or another for all metals. Recycling, of course, is better than you know, digging up raw materials and building something new. That said, recycling is not a complete solution all by itself. It also has its costs, right? Recycling is very energy intensive. It creates a lot of pollution, and it's often done on the backs of the poorest people on Earth. So yes, we should be doing more recycling, but it's not going to save us all by itself. Better than recycling is to just continue to try to get more use out of the things that we already own. Instead of buying a new phone every year or a new laptop every couple of years, you know, if you can stretch that and just keep using the thing for longer or get it repaired rather than tossing it. But the number one thing that we as individuals, just you and I as consumers, can do to really limit the damage that's caused by this whole shift to renewable energy is this. Don't buy a car, not even an electric one. All right. And I know that's really a hard pill to swallow in the United States and in Canada. And I'm not saying nobody should own a car. I'm not saying you're a terrible person if you own a car. I own a car too. But what I am saying is most people live, most Americans, most Canadians, most people in the world today live in cities, right? We live in dense urban areas where it's possible with a little careful city planning to live your life without needing a car or without needing so many cars, right? If we can promote things like bicycling, public transit, getting around by foot, car sharing, all these solutions that are all we know about already, such that we don't need quite so many cars, that will reduce our need for metals and our need for energy more than anything else we're talking about. I'll give you a quick example of how that can work from my own experience. So I used to live in Los Angeles with my wife and our two kids. And of course, we had two cars there, right? It was mom, dad, we each needed a car to get everywhere. A few years ago, we moved back to my hometown, Vancouver, Canada. And right away, we were able to get rid of one of those cars. Why? Because Vancouver, the city, has really put a lot of energy and effort into building up bicycle infrastructure so you can ride around safely, easily, decent public transit, all the rest of it. So the result is, you know, yeah, we still have a car, but now we only need one car. And I will tell you, it makes my life so much better. Not, you know, that's one less car that I've got to, you know, worry about parking and insuring and repairing and all the rest of it. It's a big, losing a car, it's a big quality of life upgrade.
The chapter Holding Power explores the critical role of batteries in the energy transition. What are some challenges of sourcing metals like nickel, cobalt, and lithium for battery production?
Yeah, so that's a great question because batteries are really kind of at the heart of it. They're the biggest consumers of just about all these metals that we're talking about. So like you said, they're mostly made modern. The batteries in all of our electronics and in most electric vehicles as well are some version or another of lithium ion batteries. And those are mostly made with lithium, nickel, and cobalt. There's other stuff in there, but those are the ones we're mostly concerned about. So lithium, the world's number one source, or one of the world's biggest sources of lithium, is a remote desert in northern Chile. And the concern there is there are these huge lithium mines there that suck up lots and lots of water from underground. And there are many scientists and many of the indigenous people living there who are really concerned that that's essentially drying out the desert. It's going to endanger everything that lives there. It is a desert, but it also has these really unique lagoons that are home to flamingos. There's other kinds of birds and wildlife that live there. And there's these indigenous communities that have been there for thousands of years. All of that is potentially imperiled by the lithium mining going on there. Nickel, like I said, the world's biggest supply of nickel comes from Indonesia, which that's just a new thing in the last 10, 20 years. They have huge amounts of nickel under the ground, and they've been moving very fast and very aggressively to start mining it and refining it. Hundreds of square miles of rainforest have been bulldozed to the ground to mine that lithium. And they've also built enormous industrial facilities to process nickel. You know, once it's dug out of the ground, you got to melt it down and separate out the nickel from the rock and all that sort of thing. Those things are incredibly polluting, just belching, you know, pollutants into the water, into the air. And then cobalt, most famously of all, almost 70% of all the cobalt in the world comes from one country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, smack in the middle of Africa. It's one of the poorest, most corrupt, most miserable countries in the world. There's, you know, it's had countless civil wars over the last few decades. Most people are living on, you know, $2 or $3 a day, and hundreds of thousands of them are working in cobalt mines in the most appalling conditions you can imagine. No safety equipment, you know, just going down into these deep hand-dug tunnels, with just a flashlight strapped onto their heads in flip-flops and shorts, chipping out cobalt with hand tools. And, you know, perhaps most shocking of all, thousands of children are also working in these operations. Kids sometimes as young as 7 years old working there. So all those things, all three of those things, you know, may very well have gone into the battery in the computer that you're talking to me on right now, or in your microphone that I can see right there, or any digital device that you can name, and any electric car.
Are there any potential breakthroughs in battery technology that could alleviate the dependence on conflict zones for rare earth metals?
Yeah, there's some really interesting research that's going on and some really promising developments around that. So there's another type of chemistry where you basically substitute the nickel and the cobalt in the battery for iron and phosphate. So they're called lithium iron phosphate batteries. So you still need the lithium, but you get rid of the nickel and the cobalt. They are not at all popular in this country yet because they're not quite as energy dense as lithium ion batteries, meaning you can't get quite as much of a charge. You can't go quite as far on a single charge with them. They've got other drawbacks and this and that. But almost half of all the new electric cars being sold in China today are using those lithium iron phosphate batteries. So I think those are definitely, we're going to see more and more of those because they have a lot of advantages. Now, that said, you know, those things, great, we don't have to depend on Indonesian nickel or Congolese cobalt. However, like anything else, those things too have their own costs. So phosphates, for instance, we mine a lot of phosphates in the state of Florida. And people there are starting to get really concerned about the damage that phosphate mining is doing to farmlands and waterways in Florida. So I think at the end of the day, it's probably less harmful, it's less stressful on the earth than nickel mining. But, you know, the thing to bear in mind is just that everything has a cost. There's no silver bullet solutions to any of these issues. And the important thing is to just be trying to do as to minimize that damage, to limit the damage as much as we possibly can.
You describe China's dominance in rare earth metals as a national security threat. I know you mentioned before that it would be beneficial for the U.S. to open additional mining operations. I was wondering if you could also speak to if Western countries could realistically reduce their dependency on these resources in other ways.
Well, so there's a lot of work going into reducing our dependence on those sources, and especially on China. So the main national security threat in all this comes from our dependence on China. So China, basically all these metals, everything we've been talking about, China dominates the entire supply chain. They dig a lot of these metals out of the ground in their own country. They own lots of foreign mines and all these places I've been talking about, Indonesia, Congo, even in part of that rare earth mine in Southern California is partly owned by a Chinese company. But no matter where those metals come out of the ground, almost all of them get sent to China for processing and refining. And then once they've been processed into refined into pure metals that can be made into those products, it's Chinese companies that take those metals and crank out the majority of the world's solar panels, wind turbines, and electric cars. So China's got a real and incredible amount of leverage there, not only economic leverage, but also geopolitical leverage if they choose to use it. And they have in the past. So back in 2010, China and Japan got into a kind of a diplomatic dispute over sort of maritime rights. And to punish Japan, China cut off supplies of rare earths to Japan, and Japan needs those rare earths for their consumer electronics industry. So all of a sudden, there was Japan with no raw materials coming in for their number one industry. It sent shockwaves throughout the whole world economy, and it was really the thing that made, you know, policymakers, military leaders, corporate execs in the U.S., all over the Western world, really kind of sit up and take notice and suddenly realize, like, holy smoke, China has really taken an incredibly powerful position re us, and we should really start doing something about it. So that's something actually the Biden administration was putting a lot of money and energy into, was trying to build up more of a domestic supply chain for this stuff. And, you know, we'll see what happens when Trump takes office.
I have more than 10 questions I need to wanted to ask you, but I only have time for one more.
Okay.
Looking forward.
Hope I give you a good answer.
Looking forward, how optimistic are you about humanity's ability to navigate the electro-digital age responsibly? What gives you hope, and what are you worried most about?
You know, I have to say I'm pretty optimistic most of the time, right? I mean, we've got huge problems to confront, for sure. But there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of people in lots of different places who are working on all this stuff in lots of really inventive and ingenious ways. And, you know, what I tell my kids is, you know, people, the human race, we're really good at creating problems, but we're also pretty good at creating solutions to them, you know? And the energy transition is actually happening a lot faster than most people realize, that switch to renewables. We don't really see it in the US so much because we're actually really behind the curve. But, you know, in China, they already get about half of their energy from renewable sources. You know, about half their cars are electric vehicles. Europe, same thing. Even in this country, the switch is really happening. Solar will soon be the number one source of energy in the United States. So it's not happening as fast as I would like, but that switch is happening. So I think we've got a good shot at beating out, at escaping the worst of climate change. And in the process, I do think we've got a good shot at also escaping the worst consequences of the shift to the electro-digital age. I'm not guaranteeing it, but, you know, I think we've got a reasonable shot.
This has been my time talking with Vince Beiser about his new book, Power Metal: The Race for the Resources That Will Shape the Future, available now from Riverhead Books. Vince, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
And now this.
You have been listening to Right On Radio. I'm Eric, and we would like to thank Vince Beisner and all of our listeners. Without your support, KFAI would not be possible.